From LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Hi, Diane Rehm.
Hi.
This is so nice. We meet again, but in a different order.
In a different way, on different sides of the desk, if you will.
I like this.
Good.
I keep thinking this is a little bit like cooking dinner for Julia Child. I mean, on one hand, it's really intimidating, but on the other hand, if I mess up, you'll be there to save the souffle.
We're just going to have a good time.
I know. It's
absolutely.
How do you like being interviewed?
Fine.
It's good?
It's good.
Do you mind talking about yourself? Just in general? This isn't how we begin. These aren't the real questions. But I find when I'm being interviewed, if I want to deflect, I start asking the interviewer questions. So do you have that sense of like, oh no, you're not, I'm the interviewer, you're not supposed to ask me questions?
No, I really believe when I'm on this side of the microphone that I am going to respond as one being interviewed and not try to take over your job, but you never know.
That's right.
You never know.
But it is, it's like going out with a, swimming with a life preserver or something. You know, I know that you can handle this. There's so many things to talk about, and I'm just going to start this off chronologically.
Okay.
At the very beginning,
good.
Your parents. Because it seems like it's where so many things start, obviously, for you and how your life was shaped. But it's also a really interesting question nationally because your parents were immigrants.
My parents were both born in a tiny town in Turkey. They were born in Mersin. At the time, Syria did not even exist. My father's family then migrated to Lebanon. My mother's family went to Alexandria, Egypt. Then in 1911, my father came here to this country with much of his family and was actually drafted at the very end of the First World War into the U.S. Army, where he served. Then, in 1929, my father went to Alexandria, Egypt, and plucked my mother from an engagement she had to another man. He must have promised her the world. Because she came here leaving behind her mother, her sister, her brother, and my father was here, almost a royal family because it was so large and so well known that I think she really had a hard time. She was depressed for most of her life, and I have written about that in an earlier book. She was such a lovely woman. She had only an eighth grade education. My father went through high school. His English was far better than hers. So other than for the Arab community in Washington, my mother did not socialize very much. She was sort of very inward.
What does your father do?
He, with his brothers, established a grocery store in Washington. So throughout the Second World War, we always had food in the refrigerator. It was great.
You must have had a ton of friends.
A ton
food,
of friends.
Food is a great way to
That's
make friends.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
But we lived in a neighborhood in Washington. I was born and raised in Washington. We lived in a wonderfully ethnically, religiously diverse area of Washington. There were Greeks, there were Italians, there were Arabs, there were Jews, and we all got together at the local playground. And that was my life. It was outside the house. It was great.
I really hate to ask you this question for fear that it will derail the whole interview. So how are you feeling about the Syrian refugee crisis?
Oh, my dear.
I mean, but there but for the grace of God, right?
Well,
I mean, you
exactly.
must feel that so
of
deeply.
Of course. And I have traveled recently to Ann Arbor, Michigan, quite near Detroit. And there is a huge conclave of Arabs in Detroit, all of whom feel so desperately the cause of those Syrians who struggle. I mean, when you look at those television photographs of those beautiful cities, and there is nothing but rubble, and it really breaks your heart. And now to learn of what's happened in Brussels, to know what is happening throughout Europe, oh my gosh, it's awful. It's awful.
So let's go back to your parents and your childhood and your parents' expectations for a daughter. What were you supposed to be? Who were you in their eyes?
My father said to me, now what you must learn to do and do very, very well is to make sure you learn how to write on the lines. Because you're going to be a secretary and you're going to be a good secretary. And in order to do that, you must learn shorthand, you must learn typing, which I did. I mean, I can type 120 words a minute.
Do you know how many books I would have written if I could type 120 words a minute?
Well, I mean, so my first job was as the assistant secretary to the director of the Department of Highways for the District of Columbia. And one of my tasks each morning, I'm so glad you asked this.
Yes, I am, aren't you?
One of my tasks was to get on the two-way radio with the fellows who were filling the potholes. Because every day, as the director drove in, he would see the potholes in the street, and he'd walk in the door with a cigar in his mouth. That was when you could smoke in a federal or district building. Say, Diane, get on the two-way and tell him to fill up the pothole on 16th Street. My first radio job. I mean, really? Yeah. So then I got recruited by the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, and a year later recruited by the Department of State, each time with an increase in wages because I guess I wrote well on the lines.
My father wanted me to be a dental hygienist, so... You're obviously a very bright girl. Did your parents ever think perhaps you should further your education?
only about a third of my high school class went to college. Mm-hmm. The year was 1954. The year I graduated was the year of Brown v. Board of Education. Mm. My mother and father did not really believe in higher education for their two girls. Within the Arab community, that was the way of thinking, that the boys, and many of them, went to college. But the girls, I mean, why go to college? You're going to get married. You're going to have children. You're going to darn your husband's socks. And that's going to be it.
Did it feel that way to you, though? Did you believe it, or did you go to bed at night and look out the window and think, oh, college?
I think because I knew that financially it was unrealistic. And frankly, at that point, I had had enough algebra. I did not think too much beyond that. As I say, at the time, only about a third went to college, and that was the norm back then. So I didn't think of myself as anything special intellectually, and I thought earning a living and paying my way at home with part of my salary made good sense.
And then your parents died.
Well,
when you were very young.
You skipped something.
Okay.
You skipped something.
Help me out.
When I was 15, I had an earache. And my father took me to the doctor. And my mother had been sick a lot.
Yes.
Off and on. And in and out of hospitals. So the doctor, with great finesse and kindness, took an instrument and jammed it into my ear.
I had that happen, yeah.
And my ear was fine after that, right?
And if it wasn't, you sure weren't gonna tell him.
And I then, through my tears, said, "Doctor, can you tell me what's wrong with my mother?" Because nobody in the household would talk about how my mother was. And with the same kindness, he jammed my ear. He said, "Your mother is very sick. She's going to be dead within 18 months." And so I went out to the car and found my father crying. He had seen the doctor first and clearly gotten the same news from the doctor. And the first words out of my father's mouth were, "Don't tell your mother. You know." Could not be talked about. Now, I knew that my mother wanted to see me married to an Arab before she died. I knew that. And so, at 19, I was married to an Arab man, a family friend. And 2 months later, my mother died. 11 months later, my father died, totally of a broken heart. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I did, because I was finally free to make a decision on my own, was to get a divorce. He was a kind man. He was a nice man. I'm still in touch with him. But he thought he was marrying his mother. And he was not.
Right.
And I think after I got to the State Department, I began to see a wider world that I had not seen at the DC Department of Highways or the US Postal Inspection Service. And the people around me seemed so educated and so wise and so knowledgeable about what was happening in the world. So I started reading books for the first time, really. And so one day on my desk at State Department were three books, and I remember them. The Essays of Alfred North Whitehead, The Brothers Karamazov, and Somerset Maugham's Of Human Bondage. And in walks a young man, tall, built like a football player, with a crew cut, a lawyer named John Rehm, who was absolutely fascinated that I, a secretary, had these books on my desk. And he was wondering why, as he did work for my boss. So we got to talking about those books. He played softball for the State Department men's team. I played softball for the State Department women's team. Second base, I was a good hitter.
I bet you were.
Good catcher, good player.
That's all it takes to be a good interviewer. You've got to be a good hitter and a good catcher.
Good. So eventually, we made a bet on the World Series that year. And I won. And he took me out to dinner. And that was our first date.
Okay, because I own a bookstore and because my entire life revolves around reading, I want to know the same thing John wanted to know. What was up with those three books on your desk? How did you come to the... Those are very specific and heady titles.
I know.
Were you going to night school? Did you have a friend who was slipping you books at the library?
Nope. I just felt surrounded by all those people, those brilliant people at the State Department that I needed to learn. And somehow, something drew me to those books. And John had gone to not only a prestigious college, but on to law school. He had been a Greek and Latin major who felt he had to earn a living, so had gone to law school and then to Wall Street and couldn't stand it and came to Washington. But I just felt I needed to know more. And those books I had heard about and had never read. So I bought paperback copies of them, and they were all on my desk.
It's interesting. One of the smartest people that I know is a model. Was a model, a great model, who dropped out of school as a teenager to become a model and was so intimidated, always feeling that other people had read everything, that she went out and read everything that it turns out no one else had read. And she wound up being smarter than the rest of us. There's a quote in the book that says, John became my teacher. There was no question I could ask him that he couldn't answer. He loved teaching me.
He did.
That's a really specific, beautiful, and dangerous dynamic. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, I think it was beautiful, and it did become somewhat dangerous later. I think those are two interesting words you've chosen. It was beautiful because his interest was global. Mm-hmm. His interest in music, his interest in literature, in art. His uncle was Arthur Dove, one of the early modernist painters. He loved standing in line at 7 o'clock in the morning at a Campbell's music store in Washington to get tickets for us to the free concerts at the Library of Congress with the Budapest String Quartet or the Guarneri String Quartet. And I had never been to a concert in my life. I had never eaten the kinds of food he knew. I had never been inside an art gallery. Can you believe that? I mean, think about today. Think about walking into the National Gallery of Art these days and seeing youngsters being pushed in their strollers into art galleries, being exposed. And he took me to the smallest, the loveliest, the most intimate art gallery in Washington, the Phillips Collection, which is like a private home. Totally unintimidating. And just walking through and sort of looking at him and feeling very self-conscious because it was the first time in my life. So everything he exposed me to helped me to grow. Every question I asked him, he would never consider beneath him. It was always, oh, isn't this fun to be helping her to learn?
I think that the most interesting people are the people who travel the farthest in the course of their life. The people who make the greatest leap. What you covered in your life is about five generations worth of life and development.
It's interesting that you put it in that way, Anne. I've never thought of making a leap. For me, it just seemed as though it was a gradual, and I accept the notion a steady progress of growth, but without him, I don't think it would have happened. When I divorced my first husband, what I knew I was doing was breaking the bounds of a generation. I felt as though I was confined by that community to a certain way of life. And I felt myself pushing against those beliefs and those certainties that they had created for me. And once my mother and father were gone, I could do that. Now, mind you, if they had not died, I would have stayed in that marriage forever.
It's one of the questions that, yes.
I could not have embarrassed them. It was the first divorce that that Arab community in Washington had ever seen. And I was shunned. They were embarrassed. They were angry. They felt betrayed. They felt, I'm sure, though they never said this to me, who does she think she is? But who I knew I wanted to be was something more than a housewife, a homemaker, and a secretary.
Have you read the Elena Ferrante Neapolitan novels?
You know, I did start one. I know that they
you must. This is your story. It really is.
I think I've told my own.
Well, it's a story you will relate to profoundly.
Yes,
anyway,
I'm sure.
So, you are married to the man you love.
Yes.
You have two little babies, and you decide you're going to volunteer at a radio station.
Well, not until they're a little older. I was a homemaker for 14 years, and I loved every minute of it. I loved it because John had helped me grow along the way. One of the first things that he did for me was to satisfy a lifelong desire to learn to play the piano.
Your two favorite presents.
Exactly.
The piano and the sewing machine.
The piano and the sewing machine.
I loved that.
And so he would come home late at night, and I'd either be playing the piano or working in the basement on the sewing machine. I learned so much in those years. I couldn't cook before we were married. I didn't know how to make anything, except he said I made the best scrambled eggs he had ever tasted. And that was about the extent of it. But he introduced me to oysters. He introduced me to veal kidneys.
What a kindness.
They're wonderful.
I will take your word for
they're
it.
They're wonderful. So, good food, richness in life. I was the one who brought entertainment into our lives by beginning to establish a wide circle of friends. By the time my children went to nursery school, always cooperative. So I was there at least twice a week, and you begin to make friends. And John had his growing status within the US government. So we were invited to very grand events and parties, and all of a sudden, my children were 13 and 10, and I'm seeing them going out the door.
You get the picture. Yeah.
More than I am seeing my need in that household, and it was about the time Betty Friedan's books were taking off. And I began thinking, what in the world am I going to be doing once they're gone? And that's when the opportunity to volunteer at WAMU came along.
In your book, it seems as if you went to volunteer and then 6 years later you had this show. It's presented almost like you're the understudy for a Broadway star who sprains her ankle and you go on and you hit it big. I think there must be more to it.
There is a little more to it. That first day, it was very much that way. I showed up as the volunteer on my first day and was met at the door by not the host, but the manager of the station, who said, you must be the new volunteer. I have some bad news. The host is out sick.
Oh, seriously?
Seriously.
It is a Broadway
thing. It is.
You're
it
Shirley
is.
MacLaine in Pajama Game.
Right.
Yeah.
So she said, the manager said to me, that she was going to host the program in the host place, and would I come into the studio with her? And I looked to my right and left, and nobody else was there. So in we went, and for 90 minutes, and we talked to a representative of the Dairy Council. And I knew about bread and milk and butter and eggs, and I also knew the new thinking at the time that maybe they shouldn't be at the top of the pyramid.
Right.
And so I began asking questions, and, you know, I was not shy.
That's an amazing story.
Well, it's a fun story, and I'll never, ever forget it. But in that 6 years, I was there for 10 months as a volunteer. Then I got a part-time job as a producer with the host. And I stayed there for 2 years developing two health-oriented programs. Then I went off to do a little television. Then I was out of work for a year, pounding the pavements. And in 1 week, the Associated Press and Physicians Radio Network both called me. And for the next 2 years, I did medical reporting, getting up at 4 a.m. to get my microphone on the stage in front of the FDA commissioner before the big networks got there. I got so sore in my shoulder from carrying all those wires. You know, I mean, you do pay your dues. Mm-hmm. And finally, one day, the host called and said, you know, I am retiring, and I just wanted to let you know. She didn't say anything more than that. And so John and I thought for a good week as to whether I should apply for the job, because it is a university-owned station. And I kept thinking, I am not university-educated. They're not going to want me. But finally, I went ahead and put my name in along with 100 other people across the country, and I got the job. So it is a fairy tale story.
It's a beautiful story.
Thank you.
You say at one point that you are having a conversation that the country must have, which is how I think your listeners feel about your show. It's so incredibly wide-ranging. And I'm wondering, there are shows in which you're sort of directing traffic, where you have three different people,
true,
and your job is to shut one of them up so the next one can talk,
right,
and move it along. But then you have other shows that are like this, that are profound conversations and connections.
And one with you on Bel Canto.
And two with me.
Two
because
with
I was
you.
On
absolutely
with State of Wonder, too.
Absolutely.
So I wondered, you know, aside from the obvious myself, who some of your favorite guests have been.
You know, this will take me way back and then bring us forward. When I was still at home, when the children mm-hmm. were quite young, I would save my ironing until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Then set up the ironing board in my sewing room, set the kids down in front of me, and turn on the television to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I believe that Mr. Rogers was one of the great teachers of our time.
I agree.
He taught not only children, but adults, kindness, thoughtfulness, tolerance for oneself and one's shortcomings, understanding of other people. He was fabulous. So, one November, I had Mr. Rogers on, and he was in Pittsburgh. He was playing the piano and doing his little meow, meow voices. All his wonderful imitations. And all of a sudden, I don't know why I asked him this, Anne, but it's sort of the way I like to let my instinct go at times. And I said to him, Mr. Rogers, do you ever get sad? And he said, oh, yes, I do. And I said, well, what do you do when you get sad? And he said, I play the piano. And he said, I think I'll be playing the piano a lot today. And I said, well, why are you sad? And it was such a profound answer that I couldn't follow it up. He said, well, my stomach hurts. And I could not go further. I could not say to him, well, why does your stomach hurt? He was dead 3 months later. Mine was the last live interview he did. And I have always remembered that 3 days later, Anne, I received a tiny little book, which now sits on my nightstand. It has a mirror on the front, and the book is titled, You Are Special. And inside, Fred Rogers had written, Diane, you really are special. With love, Fred Rogers. That, to me, was such a glorious endorsement. And I've never forgotten it. So he's right at the top, right with you.
Thank you.
How's that? How's that? How's that?
You want to tell us who the worst was?
You really want to hear this.
I actually do.
You really want to hear this. Probably a lot of our audience has read Tom Clancy.
Or someone writing under that name, yes.
Well, Tom Clancy, early in his career, came on to my broadcast, and I went out to greet him. He had on dark aviator glasses. I put out my hand to shake his and said, Mr. Clancy, it's so good to meet you. He did not put out his hand. He didn't say anything. So I figured, well, come on into the studio. We'll have a good conversation. Because unlike you and me together, I never talk to people before they come on the air. Right. I just don't do it. So I thought, you know, once he got in the studio, he'd be fine. Instead, what he did, as soon as he got into the studio and the mic was turned on, he put his hand over his eyes. And I'm thinking, this is going to be interesting. So I had read his book in detail because I figured Well, absolutely. But I figured he would be a very interesting person to talk with. He knew so much. So I gave him a really wide, good softball talk about your book question. And his answer was, yep. So So I think, well, maybe that wasn't good enough, and I put out another question, and the same thing happened. He said, nope. So I'm looking at the clock, as maybe you are now.
No, I'm not, actually.
And I'm thinking I have two choices. I can either say, Mr. Clancy, it's clear you'd rather not hear, so why don't you leave? And I'll just open the phones and talk to my listeners. Or maybe he'd rather talk to listeners himself. Maybe he doesn't like me or women or whatever. Luckily, I chose the second alternative. So I opened the phones. First caller is a man who begins by saying, Mr. Clancy, we love your books. And Clancy is smiling and saying, thank you. And then the fellow goes on to say, but you sure are being arrogant with our Diane. At which point, Clancy throws his glasses on the table and says, oh, no, we're having a wonderful time, aren't we, Diane? And the guy on the phone says, it sure doesn't sound that way to us, Mr. Clancy. And from then on, he's a pussycat. What can I tell you? Worst interview I've ever had.
Bad story, though.
But a good story, but there is a postscript. His publicist, before he died, and after he divorced or dumped his first wife, called several times to ask us to have him on again. Thank you, but no thanks.
You got it. You got it the first time.
Right.
We need to move along to what we came to talk about.
Please.
Which is your book.
Good.
Your beautiful, beautiful, moving book.
Thank you.
Your husband.
Thank you.
And his death from Parkinson's.
From Parkinson's disease, which he had suffered from for 8 years. Such a strong, vibrant man who had worked in his father's rock quarry, which was why he was built like a football player. He lost 50 pounds in the process. He went from 180 to 130. He was like that. And finally, one day, after he had moved into assisted living because he needed more help than I or a part-time caregiver could give him, he had my daughter, a doctor, on the telephone from the Leahy Clinic in Boston, where she is a practicing physician. Our son, who is or was provost at Mount St. Mary's University, in the room, his doctor and I. And John said, I am ready to die. He said, I can no longer feed myself. I can no longer stand. I can no longer walk. I am living in indignity, and I know that the path of this disease will take me even farther into indignity, and I am ready to die. And I think he really believed at that time that his doctor would simply administer a lethal dose of something. I think he really believed that that could be done. Even though we had talked about this, we both had wanted and promised each other that when the time came, we would help each other die. Mm-hmm. because my parents had died so young, his mother and father had each taken their own lives.
You need to tell me about that. That's in there. Because it's not, you mentioned that in the book, but without detail.
John's father lived by himself on his farm. He had been the sports editor for the Paris Herald Tribune before the Second World War. John's mother had gone to Paris from Philadelphia, became a fashion model in Paris. That's how the two met. John spent the first 6 years of his life in Paris. When the war was over, John's father purchased a farm in Susquehanna County, which we still have. He operated that farm that had 12 cows on it. He had never been a farmer. When he began to suffer diabetes, he encountered diabetic retinopathy. And when he could no longer see, he knew he could no longer live on the farm by himself. His mother lived in Brooklyn, John's mother. He took his own life. He was 72. John's mother lived to be 92, but because her hip and back were so bad, and she had refused to have any kind of surgery, she took her own life at 92. So death was around us.
And something that in his family there was a sense of control about.
Absolutely. And that's what he expected for himself. When the doctor said, I can neither morally, legally, or ethically help you die, the laws of the country, the laws of Maryland, where John's assisted living was, I cannot help you die. He then went on to say, the only way you, John Rehm, can bring this about is to deny yourself food, medication, and water. Now, you may know as well as I, you can go for months without food. You cannot go without water. The organs begin to break down very quickly. When we all left John's room that day, I came back the next morning not knowing what decision John would make. I came back with a photograph album I had made for him. One starting with his childhood in Paris and going all the way up to his graduation from Friends Seminary in New York and on the farm with his dad. And I got onto his bed and put my arm around him and I said, are you okay? And he said, you know what? I have not had water. I have not had food, I have not had medication, and I feel great. And I said, are you sure you want to do this? And he said, I am absolutely sure. And he was fine for 2 days, but at the end of the second day, he went to sleep. And for the next 8 days, he stayed in that situation. I was there the whole time. And I am making it my cause in life to urge people to talk within their families about what they want.
Yes.
This country is death averse.
Yes.
We do not want to talk about death, even as it is as much of a part of our lives as birth, and we don't talk about it. So I've written this memoir, not only talking about the difficulties beyond John's death and widowhood, but really urging people to gather into family groups, neighborhood groups, friendship groups. In St. Louis, there is now a group called Cupcakes and Death. And it's a group that's growing larger and larger, and they come together for snacks and coffee or drinks, or, and they look at all the documents and they talk about what they need, what they want, how they wish to be dealt with at the end of life. How wonderful, how refreshing. Oregon, California, state of Washington, state of Vermont have all passed these laws allowing death with dignity. Now, what does that mean, Anne? It has nothing to do with euthanasia, which is what people always jump to. Are you talking about putting people to sleep? No. What Oregon has done is to allow two physicians to make the judgment that this individual, which my husband was, 6 months away from dying, two physicians must certify that, and the individual must be able to say that he or she wishes to die. Ultimately, medication is given to that individual by a physician, and then the physician is out of it. So in Oregon, some thousands of people have asked for and been given this medication, and 1/4 of those have never used it. What they have felt is empowered.
Yes.
Empowered to make choice their own. And that's what I want for myself. When Governor Jerry Brown signed the California law, his last paragraph, and I'm paraphrasing here, was something like, I do not know what I would do if I were suffering and near the end of my life. The only thing I do know is that I would not want someone else to make that choice for me. And that, for me, is what's so important. And that's what I'm fighting for. Thank you.
Do you feel discouraged by your station's response to your involvement with the Care and Compassion Group?
You know, I think I got my nose out of joint a little bit when they came
Tell
to
that
me.
Story.
Well, I had several programs with a representative of Compassion and Choices and with an individual, Dr. Ira Byock, who believes that Compassion and Choices is close to euthanasia. He believes that palliative care should always be available, that what we need to do is not think about death with dignity, but rather to think about improving palliative care. I'm all for it. I think if you and decide you want to live as long as God allows you to live, that should be your choice. And if you say, I want palliative care to keep me alive as long as it can, that should be your choice. At the same time, if I am sick and I know that I have a choice between palliative care, more chemotherapy, more radiation, or choice of dying, I personally am going to choose death with dignity. I shocked, I think, some television viewers on a program not long ago by saying, and I don't mean to shock you
just
now.
Just try, you're not.
If I suffer a heart attack, if I suffer a stroke, I am now 79. I will be 80 in September. I've had a fabulous life. I will not call 911. I do not wish to go to a hospital to be intubated, to die in a sterile room with no one but doctors and nurses surrounding me.
But the problem is, and you know, okay, you're not going to call 911, but
right,
your doorman will, you know, but your neighbor who hears you fall. But do you know what I'm saying? It's the other.
I don't think so in my case.
If you drop in the station, in the street, there is
that's
such,
another problem.
There is such a moment in life of always saying, grab on.
I know.
Not you, but the people around
you. Of course.
So what you have to make yourself ready for is that someone's going to drag you into the back of an ambulance.
Not me. And I'll tell you.
Do you have the ID bracelet?
Well, I'll tell you what happened on the way home from Seattle. Not long ago, I had gotten to Seattle and I felt a sore throat coming on. This was the first big stop on the book tour, speaking at Microsoft, speaking at Seattle Town Hall, and I really was getting sick. So on the way home, we're about half an hour out of Washington, and I start shivering. Mm. And it was that incredible shivering that I was pushing against myself to try to stop. A doctor was called. They took my temperature. It was 101 plus. They took my blood pressure. It was 180.
Oh, God.
And my blood pressure is usually 120 over 60 or something like that. So they called medics, and they had medics waiting at the airport and wheeled me out and saying, we got to take you to the hospital. I said, no, you're not taking me to the hospital. Luckily, a friend happened to be on the same plane. She said she wants to go home. And she and I were very firm. And they, the medics, were saying, no, we really have to take you to the hospital. You have to stand for what you want.
But there's a difference between a heart attack, a stroke, and needing antibiotics.
So we got in a limousine. And my friend called the station, which called my daughter the doctor, which called my son in Pennsylvania, who drove down. Jenny ordered the medication. David went and got it, came home, slept overnight in my apartment, and I was sick for 3 weeks. That. But what I'm telling you is you got to push against what you don't want. And in today's medical system, you have to prepare yourself mentally to be able to do that. And I've given you a simple example by virtue of I had the flu, which is what it was, versus a stroke or a heart attack. I want to go peacefully, quietly in my own home.
I think we all do.
Exactly.
And I think it's, you talk about the cupcake and death. We're a country that can't even make out a will.
I know it. I know it. John and I did that years and years and years ago.
But people are so paralyzed. They just don't have the words.
So the words are, if you are an adult and your parents are getting a little older and you're getting a little concerned, the way you might begin is simply hoping you're not going to get your head knocked off by saying something like, you know, I've been thinking about my own young children, thinking about what I'm going to do to take care of them. Have you all thought about what you would like us to do?
Right.
I mean, you've got to open the conversation. If the older people in the room don't do it, then the younger ones need to do it. Our generation is going to be the largest portion of the population before you know it. And we've got to think about, I'm telling you, nursing homes are not where you want to be.
I know.
They're not where you want to be.
Can I?
I think people agree.
And can I say that the best place that I can think of to begin this conversation is to have people read your book? Because I think that your book is so full of contradiction and doubt and love
life.
And loss and life and life. Grief, and it's exactly the way it is. It's not just I'm settled. It's confusion and questioning and grappling, which is what you do on your show day after day. It's open-hearted and open-minded and layer after layer of love and joy and loss and grief and pain and love and joy. And I think it's a beautiful beginning for everyone's conversation.
Oh, thank you,
and
Anne. That's lovely.
From the bottom of my heart, say it has been such an honor to sit across this table
from
you.
Oh, and my honor.
Thank you.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.